Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
Your host. Foreclosures are something we hear a lot about today. I think you see one on almost every street. Last February, 6 million homeowners were in danger of losing their homes. The question is, were some of these homeowners wrongfully foreclosed upon? Well, the article I'm about to read came from MSNBC.com 2 days ago, and it was titled, U.S. Close to Punishing Banks Over Foreclosures. This article was both shocking and alarming. Again, the article was on MSNBC, dated February 17th, titled U.S. Close to Punishing Banks over foreclosures. The article was quite lengthy, so I won't read everything in it, but I will read what I consider the highlights. It said U.S. bank regulators are finalizing punishments against mortgage servicers after a probe found critical deficiencies with the industry's foreclosure processes. John Walsh, the acting head of the Office of Comptroller of Currency, said a national probe of foreclosure paperwork and procedures found that mortgage servicers broke laws and that a small number of homeowners were wrongfully evicted. Walsh said in a congressional testimony obtained on Wednesday by Reuters, these deficiencies have resulted in violations of state and local foreclosure laws, regulations, and rules, and have had an adverse effect on the functioning of the mortgage market and the U.S. economy as a whole. Walsh did not identify the servicers, but his testimony noted that the probe included Bank of America, Citibank, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo, among others. In a separate testimony on Wednesday, that's this past Wednesday, David Stevens, the commissioner for the Federal Housing Administration, that's FHA, said that penalties could range from fines paid to the government to loan modifications to banks for giving some of the principal balances on the loans. But Walsh had said in the past that regulators have the power to seek monetary penalties against the servicers and to issue criminal referrals. So this is much bigger than they initially led us to believe. It says the biggest U.S. mortgage servicers have been accused of taking possible illegal shortcuts in some foreclosure proceedings, such as using robo-signers to sign hundreds of unread documents a day and advancing foreclosures without proof they held the mortgages. And then Walsh went on to say that his testimony prepared to be delivered on Thursday before the Senate was that mortgage servicers emphasize speed and cost efficiency over quality and accuracy in their foreclosures. That said, if someone you know or yourself has been foreclosed upon, I would suggest that you speak with a professional like the one we have on today's show, Mr. Ray Williams with Greenway Capital Management. A reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. And also a reminder, the chat room is open today. Our guest today, again, like I said, is Mr. Ray Williams. He is president of Greenway Capital Management. He has been in he has over 22 years of experience in credit counseling, 12 years in the mortgage industry, and has specialized in foreclosure counseling for the past 2 years. Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time here on Center Stage, help me to welcome Mr. Ray Williams. Good afternoon, Ray.
Good afternoon, Ray.
How are you?
Excuse me, your listeners. I'm doing well.
Good. Listen, you heard what I just read, and we talked about this article a little earlier. What should someone do who may relate to that article and question whether or not they were wrongfully foreclosed upon? What do you suggest they do?
Well, if they have actually been through the foreclosure process, that's a situation where they would have to get an attorney to try to get the foreclosure reversed.
Okay, gotcha.
Based on the evidence that it was illegal.
Okay. So they would need to get an attorney.
Well, no, in this case, they should get an attorney because if the property has actually been foreclosed.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, for someone...
Yeah, because that's go ahead.
Okay, for someone who is facing a foreclosure, so someone who may be in their house right now and questioning whether all the I's had been dotted and all the T's crossed and whether or not the mortgage company or the servicer has done what they were supposed to do, what do you suggest they do?
Well, in that particular case, Carrie, the consumer would have to go to someone who understands the process and who knows the laws and the regulations under the programs. Or they need to contact the mortgage company and ask the mortgage company, you know, what are the rules and regulations. But generally, they need to speak with someone who have the information.
Okay. Now, for someone like yourself, Greenway Capital Management is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Are you able to talk with people across the United States?
Yes, we can counsel anyone in the United States, because basically the program applies to everyone, and all the rules and regulations are equal across the country.
Now, for someone who it may be in the middle of a foreclosure process, explain to them the steps that happen, because we know from state to state it varies from, you know, when you're going to be evicted to some people staying in the house up to a year. What happens when a person gets to the point that they know they cannot make the mortgage? What happens at that point? What should happen at that point? The point that you know you can no longer make your payments, what should you do?
Well, if you know you can't make the payments and you don't want the property, then you should seek some type of alternative solution outside of foreclosure. For example, a short sale.
What if they want to stay in the house? Or what if they're going through the foreclosure but they actually want to stay there?
Okay, if they want to stay in the house, then they need to apply for a modification through the servicer. Because generally, if they haven't already done that, now if they have already applied and was declined for whatever reason, I suggest they reapply.
Okay, explain
what
a loan modification.
Because sometimes it may be.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I said sometimes people are declined improperly because the mortgage servicer did not follow the procedures during the. Qualification stage, and they have declined homeowners when they did actually qualify. So they should reapply if they are declined.
Okay, explain what the loan modification is. What is that?
Okay, the loan modification basically under the government program, which is HAMP, which is the Home Affordable Mortgage Program, which is part of the bailout money was funded to banks to help consumers stay in their home. And the modification basically consists of modifying the loan in order to make it affordable for the homeowner to keep the home. So, for example, most modifications are done through interest rate reduction or an extension of terms. So, and under the HAMP rule, your payment cannot be more than 31% of your mortgage. And if it is more than 31% of your gross income, so for example, if your gross income is $3,000 per month, and let's use round numbers, and say that would be $900. So if your payment is $1,300, then you qualify for a payment reduction.
Okay.
So under the HAMP program is designed to lower your payments, some cases temporarily, a lot of cases permanently. For example, 2%, 2.25% temporary interest rates for 5 years, and then the interest starts to increase again after that 5-year period, and it has a cap also, so it'll never, you know, become a subprime interest rate.
Okay, so the modification, what if you don't fit into those ratios? What happens?
Well, if you don't fit far as the payment ratio of 31%, then you may can do a workout. If it's a case where you can afford the payments, but you're delinquent and you need to catch up payments, and that would be under a workout plan. Now, the workout plan, let's just say if a homeowner is 6 months delinquent and they have other charges amounting to, let's say, use a number of $9,000. With the workout plan, they basically go in and work out a plan where you can make a down payment and add additional money to the monthly payment for up to 12 months in order to bring the payment current. Now, you can, which is similar to a forbearance.
I was just saying, is there a difference?
Forbearance,
okay. Explain the difference. Explain the difference between the forbearance agreement and the loan modification.
Okay, the forbearance is similar, whereas the forbearance, they do not lower the payments, they actually increase the payments. So with the forbearance, let's say, for example, if you're 6 months delinquent and they'll give you a forbearance, and they'll add, let's say, an additional 20% or 30% to your monthly payments in order for you to catch up payments. Whereas the modification is the reverse, they reduce the payments.
Hmm, okay. You mentioned the HAMP program. Was that the one that was initiated by President Obama?
Yes, that is.
What was the percentage of people that were actually helped under that program? It was not very many, correct?
No, actually, it's a very small number compared to what had been projected. They had projected 3 to 4 million homeowners would be assisted, and as of January, that number was still under 500,000. So it basically, you know, some sources have said that the program is a failure.
Okay.
And when you look at the numbers, I guess we can equate it to failure if you didn't meet your 3 or 4 million goal in 2 or 3 years.
Well, when you're going to your mortgage company, then seeing that that particular program is not reaching very many people, should you be asking your mortgage or your mortgage company or your servicer to put you on that program, or are you asking for just whatever program they have available to stop your house from going into foreclosure?
Yes, Gary, they should ask for whatever is available. But now the negative side to it is sometimes when companies do their in-house foreclosures, they are not obligated by any government rules.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically set their own rules on an in-house foreclosure, in-house modification. Whereas with the HAMP program, there are certain guidelines they must follow during the process.
Okay. So there's a such thing as an illegal foreclosure. Explain what an illegal foreclosure is.
Okay, Karen, basically illegal foreclosure, meaning they did not take the proper procedures according to each state's law prior to foreclosing. For example, Texas. In Texas, you have to receive a summons. You have to receive a notice within 30 days. They have to post a notice in the courthouse. They also have to notify the homeowners within 30 days of the foreclosure. And if they don't follow those procedures, then it's an illegal foreclosure. And, for example, if you did not receive a notice that the property will be foreclosed on a certain date and they actually go to the courthouse step and foreclose, then that would be an illegal foreclosure. So anytime they don't follow the guidelines, it's considered illegal.
So if a borrower was being very smart, they would document everything.
Oh, yes, Eli, that's one thing about it. You definitely want to document everything in regarding trying to save your home.
Gotcha. When you're actually trying to negotiate your property getting out of foreclosure, when they started the foreclosure process, when you're calling the servicer or you're calling the mortgage company, is there a particular language that you should be using? Is there a particular department that you should be asking to speak with when you're calling in to talk about your foreclosure?
Well, generally you will speak to customer service. Depends on what stage the foreclosure is in. And if it's in the severe stages where the property they have actually filed foreclosure, then you would speak to the loss mitigation department.
Okay.
And you definitely, you know, always want to get the person you spoke with, what time you spoke with that person, what was said, you want to know the status of the property. But definitely you want to speak to the right people. And unfortunately, sometimes that can be a difficult task.
Well, that said, when you speak with them and document, of course, who you spoke with and when you spoke with them and, you know, all of that, and their job title and all of that, you also want to send in specific paperwork. What is it specifically they're going to want you to provide them to help negotiate this foreclosure process or stop the foreclosure process? What is it that they would be looking for?
Okay, generally they want to see the most 30-day recent bank statements, most 30-day copy of pay stubs, 2-year tax returns, a recent utility bill. And the objective is to verify that the homeowner does not have sufficient funds to make payments or to catch up the payments.
Okay. No, we're not telling anybody to you know, try to stay in a house necessarily when you know you're not going to make the payment. But we do know that there is a such thing in what you say can prolong your ability to stay in a particular situation. Is that not correct?
That is correct, Carrie. Generally, once they start the process of a modification, then the foreclosure is suspended temporarily. But now also, once the foreclosure is suspended, it's always in foreclosure status. So basically, once they go to foreclosure status, even if they're trying to work out through a modification or workout plan, the property is always considered in foreclosure.
Foreclosure. Okay.
But it also, that's good because it buys time.
Okay. So how quickly should the customer or / borrower contact their mortgage company when they reach a status of, let's say, inability to pay the mortgage, whether that's due to, a medical issue or loss of employment or whatever the circumstances may be, at the point in which they know next month I'm going to have trouble making this payment, what should they do?
And they should do that immediately. When they know that they cannot make their payment, then they should contact the mortgage servicer and inform them. And they also can ask for a 30-day extension, which will put that particular payment on the back end, as they call it in the industry, and which means you are not considered late because they gave you an extension. But you always want to call up front. If they don't give you an extension, sometime they will accept a partial payment. So they will work with you because the mortgage services don't want the account to go into a 30-day, a 90-day, or definitely don't want it to go into a foreclosure status. But they will work with homeowners if the homeowners take action up front.
But isn't it the case that most borrowers are afraid to let the mortgage company know that a situation has occurred and they're not going to be able to make the payment?
Well, so yes, sometimes people feel guilty of not being able to make their payments. But that's the last thing that, you know, they should feel because, again, the services want to work with you in order to avoid a late payment. Now, let me explain why. Because the services basically are a collection agency. They get paid to collect accounts and to collect on time. So if you cannot pay on time, it's in their best interest, rather, to give you an extension and let you skip that payment and put it on the back end because it looks good on their records for how many delinquent accounts they have. So they can minimize how many 30-day delinquent accounts they have in their portfolio if they give payment extensions.
Okay. If I'm someone who, let's just say, is a little shy or don't feel like I'll know the proper language to use, and I'm afraid that if I use the wrong language, that could result in me getting in a foreclosure situation and then in turn losing my house. Can I have a third party to call in for me?
Yes, you can have a third party, Carrie. Basically, you just get an authorization letter, have that person assign the letter, and fax that letter or email it to the servicer, informing the servicer that that person have a right to receive information regarding the account. Mm-hmm. And that works for a lot of people because, again, a lot of people don't feel comfortable speaking to the services because they don't understand the terminology or understand the industry or finance. So, you know, even when they speak with the services, they feel lost after the conversation because it's like I heard them, but I didn't understand what they were saying.
Understand that. But when you're giving someone a letter of authorization, that's a pretty powerful document. So you really don't want to give that to someone you really don't know that well, correct? Or you're really not sure about whether or not the business practice is that of a good, I guess, business or a solid, sound business? Because that gives them a lot of access to your information, correct?
Well, yes, it does, because when you get that authorization, you're telling the mortgage company you can speak with this person regarding anything on my account. And sometimes you really want to be careful because in some cases you have to give, sometimes you may have to give your full Social Security number.
Exactly.
So yeah, yes, you definitely want to be careful of and make sure it's a legitimate company that you that you're dealing with.
When you were talking about, you know, dealing with the customer service department, one of the things I read in the article was one lady said she had faxed the same documents 11 times, and each time she'd fax it, they say, "We didn't get it. We didn't get it. We didn't get it." So should, when someone sends in these documents, they should not take for granted that the document got there. There should be follow-up calls to and confirmations from someone on the other end that these documents were received, correct?
That's correct, Carrie, because that's a big problem in the industry, is that when homeowners send documents in, the mortgage companies claim that they did not receive the documents. So you always want to do a follow-up. Now, generally, the way it works is that you send a document in, you wait 3 days, then you conduct a follow-up call to verify that they have the documents. And if they don't, then you refax the docs again, the documents again. So you always want to follow up, because if you don't, then the mortgage company have a right to decline the request for a modification because you did not send the documents in. Even though you sent them in, they can say, well, we did not receive them. So you always want to verify that they did receive the documents.
Is there any recourse when you have, say, faxed your documents 3 times and you know you faxed them, your fax machine gave you a confirmation that it was received on the other end, and you keep being told that they haven't received them? Because one of the things in the article I just read said that they had a robo-signer that was signing off on documents that no one ever read. So saying that these properties were to go in foreclosure and no one had ever read them to see what they were even all about. So what do you think? What should they do?
Well, okay. Well, like, again, for as confirming that the documents get there, again, there's only really 2 ways, is to get a verbal confirmation or to send the document by certified mail or FedEx. Or actually 3 ways, so you send it FedEx or some way where someone has to sign to say that those documents were received. Now, as far as the robo-signing, that was on the, I would say, the opposite end of the spectrum, because robo-signing was more about people verifying that they had reviewed the documents prior to foreclosure.
Okay.
In some states, before they can initiate a foreclosure, they have to verify that information is correct, because they have judicial foreclosures. Whereas in Texas, for example, and some other states where they do not have judicial foreclosure, you don't have the robo-signing issue, because you sign a deed of trust, basically giving the servicer the right to foreclose on the property if you default on the loan.
Okay. For those people who may be in the areas of where judicial foreclosures take place, explain what that is.
Well, judicial meaning that before they can foreclose, it has to go to court. You have to go through a court procedure. You go before a judge, and the judge will determine whether the property should be foreclosed or not.
Okay.
So with the robo-signing, what they were doing, they had people signing a document saying, well, we verified that all the information in these documents are correct. So when they went before the judge, they had, you know, basically said, you know, on the oath that this is information is correct in the documents. We did all our work according to the law, and this is a legal foreclosure.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHC 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, Can I Stop My Foreclosure? We're speaking with Mr. Ray Williams. He is a foreclosure and credit expert, and he's with Greenway Capital Management here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1, or if you're listening via the Internet, dial in at 347-850-8390, and again, press 1. Some of the things I also found, Ray, that was kind of shocking was that there were certain states where it seemed to be heavier activity than others where the foreclosures were going on at. It seemed like the areas where they had the most foreclosures were areas like Washington, Oregon, Idaho, California, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Georgia, Illinois, Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Missouri. Now, why that's the case, I'm not sure. But they said in California, they had like 67%, Florida 21%, and Michigan over 15%. They had the highest amount of new foreclosure activity in California, Florida, and Michigan. Like I said, 67% in California. That's pretty high. So something's got to be going on. You think the market maybe was, they were a little upside down, and then people just chose to walk away? Or what do you think the situation was?
Well, it varies in each state, but most of those states was because of the type of loans that people received. For example, the adjustable rate mortgage loans.
Yeah.
And because, you know, during the mid-2000s, when the subprime industry was booming, a lot of people were put into subprime mortgages with adjustable rate interest.
Right.
Then you had the other program. California had a lot of creative financing because of the high price of the mortgages. So they had these creative financing that if the consumers did not read the paperwork, they were signing basically saying, well, your interest rate can go from 2% to possibly 9 or 10% after 2 years or 3 years, whatever that number is. So when that period came around and all of a sudden the adjustment took place, your payment may have went from, say, $1,300 to maybe $2,700.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there were some other things possible with the issues of qualifying. A lot of people may have been put into homes that they did not qualify for. But the main reason a lot of these homes are foreclosing is because of the adjustable rate mortgages. And naturally, if consumer rate adjusts and the payment adjusts by $300 or $400 per month, that can put them in a predicament of non-affordability on the payment. So, and then now you mentioned, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you mentioned Michigan, whereas, you know, look at states like Michigan. Michigan had, it was a high unemployment state because of the automobile industry.
Gotcha.
So they had a double whammy, say, because they had to deal with high unemployment and, you know, maybe adjustable rate mortgages at the same time. So, but basically, it's just a combination of things.
Because I thought it was threefold. I thought you're right with the adjustable rate mortgages. I thought two, maybe the interest only loans, and then I thought 100% financing killed a lot. Because if you didn't have any equity built into it, when things got kind of crazy, it would be easy to just walk away. You know what I'm saying?
That's true. Yes, I'm sorry. That is true because again, you know, if you have nothing into the property, then it's easier to walk away, especially if you're rate adjusted and you can't afford the payment, and you can walk away and lose no equity, damage your credit, you know, which you can recover from that. So
right.
That is part of it also.
I agree. And what I found that they said that 1 in 94 housing units received a foreclosure filing in 2010. That's like, wow, you count 100 houses, just about, and then there's one, you know. So that tells you that some kind of way this whole crisis or crash with the mortgage industry, it was bound to just happen. It was set up wrong because there were so many different types of loans that, especially the ARMs, because if you set a guy up when he qualifies on a 5 and you tell him that, you know, it could go up to a 10, but we're just going to anticipate that you're going to get some more money, you're going to get some raises when the raises may never come, that's crazy by itself. You know,
well,
so you're anticipating that he's going to get raises on his job when, in fact, he could lose his job. There's no guarantees in life.
Yes, and that's what happened, Carrie. A lot of people were getting into mortgages that they really couldn't afford to begin with, but because they made it, you know, so easy because the government basically was pushing home ownership, and that's when we had all type of creative financing in addition to the faith-based lending. I mean, it was just all kind of things going on that was basically pushing people into home ownership. A lot of these people were not ready for home ownership.
Very true. Explain this. They said that almost every state provides for some period of redemption. Can you explain what the period of redemption means in terms of if you're in the situation of a foreclosure?
Yes, Gary, redemption basically means you can redeem the property after a certain period if you take certain actions. For example, if the property is foreclosed in California, I'm not sure, but I think it's still 1 year statutory redemption, which means that if you can come up with the funds to make up the payments and pay some other additional costs, you can get the property back out of a foreclosure from whoever purchased the property in the foreclosure.
Tell us a little bit about what Greenway Capital Management does. The laws have changed a little bit in terms of going to companies, and I want you to elaborate because I'm not sure about all the specifics, but the law has changed a little bit about paying people up front to help you stop your foreclosure. So tell us what Greenway Capital Management has done to still help people in foreclosures, in a situation of a foreclosure.
Okay, Carrie. Well, first of all, let me explain what happened with the change in the program for his payment. There was a lot of scams going on and are still going on. And unfortunately, a lot of consumers were taken advantage of by companies, you know, that was calling themselves foreclosure prevention companies, and they were getting fees anywhere from $800 up to $5,000 up front and basically doing nothing. So as of the 31st of January of this year, the government has said that no company cannot accept a payment up front for the work. You can only receive payment after the work is performed. Mm-hmm. Now, that has a backlash on homeowners also, because even though the government have programs out there, various housing agencies and counseling agencies that's supposedly be designed to help consumers, they don't do, I believe, my own personal opinion, they're not as effective as a private source. Mm. For example, you know, a private source would be like more in tune to assisting their customer because that customer is paying them for the work. So you are acting on behalf of your customer, and your job is to do the best you can to help your customer get a modification or stay out of foreclosure. So now with this new law in place, companies, you know, not being able to accept payments, you know, are saying, well, you know, we can't do this because, you know, we can't work for no money up front. Now,
what were some of the fees they were charging? Now, weren't the fees kind of high that they were charging with you not having any guarantee of whether or not they were going to be able to stop your foreclosure?
Well, yes, they were, but that was a play on people's emotions because, again, you have people that are stressed out. They're about to lose their homes. And if you can convince them that if they pay you $5,000, you can provide assistance, you know, a lot of people would do it.
Wow.
And
so
that was a problem, you know.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was finished.
So what does your company do that's different? What does Greenway Capital Management?
Well, what Greenway Capital Management do, we basically decided that for in the best interest of homeowners is to educate homeowners. So what we do, we provide education through workshops and seminars. And basically, we just get consumers, we educate them on the foreclosure process, we educate them on the rules and laws for modification, we educate them on what it takes to get a modification and how to and the flow of the process. And then we mentor them through the process. So this way, the consumer has the information and they have the guidance necessary to reach their goals of keeping their home or getting their payments reduced. And the good thing about this program is that it educates consumers. It gives them something for the future. So if they face the situation again, they'll know exactly what to do and how to do it, opposed to paying someone who do all the work and their situation occur again and you have to go out and pay someone again. So we believe that education is the best way, you know, for a consumer to handle their own financial situation.
Okay, what's the cost of your program?
Our class is $435. It's a five-hour class, but we also, again, it comes with that is unlimited mentoring throughout the whole process. So if it takes 6 months, then we are there during that six-month period. You can call us, email us whenever you have a question or something you don't understand. And now also what we do is that if you want us to handle your case personally after you attend the class, we will take it, the case personally, and you pay after the work is done.
Yeah.
So they have a choice there, at least.
So if you're based in Texas, if let's just say this is a situation in California, how are you going to mentor them, or how are you going to do your class in California?
Well, we can, you know, we'll consider California based on the how many people sign up for the class.
Okay.
So we have a limit on, you know, based on the distance. And what we are also working on is setting up, people in those areas, in certain areas, that will conduct classes based on the state. But at this point, if someone wanted, you know, us to come and teach that, you know, it would not be economically feasible to go there and teach a class of 10 people.
Okay.
Now,
so
we're also setting up, we will have webinars also, where, you know, that's one of the things we're working on now is our webinars where anyone from any, you know, state would be able to take the class online.
So right now, pretty much you are staying within a 600-mile radius of where you are, or of the Dallas-Fort Worth area right now, correct?
Correct, yes. We basically go 600-mile radius.
Okay. What kind of situations are you finding, though, when you're teaching people this process? Are people able to retain? Because I have a mortgage background and you have a mortgage background, and you know it takes years to get all of the information down pat. So how can you fast forward someone enough for them in a situation of a foreclosure to get savvy enough to negotiate that situation with their mortgage company?
Again, that's why we have the mentoring side of it, because we know that a five-hour class, they won't learn everything, and the objective is not to teach them everything, but to give them the important details and of the process itself. So for example, if they understand the HAMP rules, which we give to them in the class in the handout, so let's say if they're declined for a modification, but they never receive a notice that they were declined, then that's not a legal declination, because by the HAMP guidelines, if they decline you, they're supposed to notify you in writing that you were declined and why.
Okay.
So if you know certain rules, that gives you the power to work with the servicer and get the positive results. Now, that brings up another question. Foreclosures,
mm-hmm.
you know, 85% of people who were foreclosed unnecessarily, which
right.
means a lot of times they should not have been foreclosed, and maybe because they did not approach the servicer, or they did not know how to approach the servicer the right way. So that's what we do. We provide them with the information and the education, and then we mentor them through the process.
Okay. We talked the other day about what bank was doing the most foreclosures, and who did you tell me it was?
Bank of America. Last count, they had a little over, I think it was $1.3 million or $1.5 million.
Right.
That was in process.
I would suggest to anybody who is carrying a situation with or a mortgage with Bank of America, and you may be facing foreclosure, you definitely need to get in touch with Ray Williams to help you negotiate that situation, because obviously they're moving the paperwork along so fast and so sloppily that they're probably foreclosing on four more people than they should be. Far more people, like, I guess is what I'm trying to say,
yeah.
than they should be, which is I'm surprised that a bank of that size and with that type of reputation would be doing that. That was the surprising. The names that came up, like Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan and Bank of America, that was surprising that those were some of the ones that were involved in the scandal. I don't know why I thought it was I'm sorry?
No, I say, if you look at it, what happened is that this situation just, you know, started occurring about less than 4 years ago. So the services were not prepared for it. So they did not have the experienced people. They did not have, you know, the service and the department set up to handle the volume. So in essence, they had to go out and hire a lot of new and inexperienced people. So that's why there's so much turmoil.
Very true. I think I did find in some of the research that there was such a high demand when they started these servicing companies that they were literally bringing people out of McDonald's. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with anybody working in McDonald's, but there's a lot of difference between working in McDonald's and working in the mortgage industry and working with deeds of trust and all the other types of documents that are involved, people's financial statements and credit reports and things like that. That's a whole lot more detailed than someone working at McDonald's. And I understood that they brought in people with little to no experience and had these people working these desks. And so that was shocking that they did not seek out trained professionals who at least understood the documentation to fill those vacancies. I thought that was shocking.
Yeah, well, again, it was based on pressure because they were thrust into a situation where it was, you know, time is of essence. So, you know, you have all these requests coming in and all these potential foreclosures, but you don't have trained people. So you basically hire a lot of people and give them, from my understanding, most of the companies provide anywhere between 2 to 3 days of initial training. Then
you can't get it in 2 to 3 days.
Which they know that also, but see, it's a matter of paperwork piling up, and they need to start moving the paperwork, so they can't spend a whole lot of time training people. And also, another problem in the industry is the turnover ratio. They have a very high turnover ratio because these people are under a lot of pressure to basically, they have quotas to meet basically each day. So it's a high-pressure job also for them. So they have a, you know, increase in turnover. You know, they outsource. You know, a lot of times you call, you'll get someone in India, Pakistan, or somewhere.
And
so
I would
there are a lot of issues in the industry.
A lot. I would suggest to anybody, if you call into your mortgage provider or servicer or whatever you want to call them, and you get somebody on the phone that clearly is not understanding what you're saying, I suggest you ask for a supervisor, because the documentation is so crucial to getting to your file on time. The time frame in which it gets there is so crucial. So I would suggest at any point in which the communication seems to be failing between you and the person on the phone, you need to go a step higher than that individual, and even maybe take it up to the top of the company, because time is of the essence when you're dealing with the foreclosure. Is that not correct?
Oh yeah, definitely, Carrie. You know, time is the essence, and you want to know what's going on anyway, because again, there have been cases where people did not know what the status of the foreclosure was, and next thing they know, they come home and all the furniture is out on the curb because the property was foreclosed, but they never received the notice of the foreclosure. And now in Texas, once the foreclosure takes place, then generally, the homeowner has 30 days to move out. So if you don't know that the property was actually foreclosed, and the sheriff, if the sheriff delivered the notice or and someone took the notice off the door, notifying you that you have 30 day, or a certain date to be out by, and if you're not out on that date at that time, then the sheriff come and set all your items on the curb. And that have happened because the mortgage company in a lot of cases did not send the notices out. In those cases, you can get back in the property if you can prove that you did not receive the notice.
Okay, what are the stages of a foreclosure? For those of us who may not understand, at the point in which you are not able to, let's just say you reach a point of being not capable of making your payment and you start falling behind, what are the steps? When you get that first foreclosure letter, this is, we're going to foreclose unless you make X, Y, Z in payment. What is the procedures? If that person fails to do what they need to do, what can happen from that point on?
Well, from that point, if they don't respond in any way to the notice, then naturally, just, you know, when the foreclosure date comes, it goes to Courthouse Stiff in Texas case, and it's foreclosed on. But now, if you receive the notice and you want to abort the foreclosure, then you need to contact your servicer and start working with them on some type of plan or see if they have a program that you qualify for. Now, what generally will happen, they will suspend the foreclosure while they're trying to work with you. So if you call up And they see they can actually suspend the foreclosure all the way up to the last minute. So, you know, there have been cases where foreclosure was stopped, or where they call the attorney and say, well, take this particular property off the list.
So they will
work with you. Go ahead.
It's very important to communicate with them.
Oh, yes, definitely, because that's what they want. Because, you know, you think about it, if you do not communicate, they can only assume that you don't want to keep the property.
Mm-hmm. When do you know it's time to stop fighting to save your property and just walk away? My example is that if you are so far behind that you're what I consider upside down, meaning that if they let you keep your house, you still going to be paying for it long after you dead, or the fact that your house is going to cost you more than anybody else's on the street by the time you finish paying for it, then it may be a situation in which it's time to walk away. That's my example and what I think is time sometimes for people to stop fighting the foreclosure and walk away. But when would you say to a person it's time to walk away?
Well, only when they have exhausted any possibilities. When you know that you have tried everything and there's no way you can keep the property. Now, you mentioned one thing on being upside down. Now, see, as far as walking away from a home that's upside down, that's a matter of it's a personal thing, because some people are not concerned about the value. They just want to live in that house maybe the rest of their life. And sure, you know, they may pay a lot more than the house is worth, but to them, to live in that house and to have that home is more important. Now, another thing is, even if you're upside down, you can still pay less than what you owe, because you can negotiate with the mortgage company to knock off some of the principal based on the fact that it's underwater.
Okay. Now, let's discuss how we can knock off some of our principal. How does that happen? How can you call in and say, I want y'all to take away this $80,000 balance and drop me to $50,000? How do you do that?
Well, that will be based on the property values for that particular area. So if you can show evidence that, let's say, for example, if you have your property appraised and it comes back appraised at, let's say, $80,000, and the other homes in that area are going for, $60,000, or let's go lower, let's say $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if you can show in that in the comparables, in that appraisal, when they take the three additional properties and those properties come back appraised at, say, $50,000 and yours is at $80,000, and there are no other homes in that area that's selling for $80,000, then that's a case for the mortgage company to say, well, okay, to help you stay in the home, we'll reduce the principal. Now, the thing is, though, what you have to understand is that when they reduce that principal and forgive that, whatever that amount is, let's say in this case, let's just say it's just $30,000, that $30,000 may be taxable, and they also may send you a 1099 as income on that $30,000.
Gotcha. So are you only able to negotiate this type of arrangement with your mortgage company if you're behind, or can you make this type of arrangement if you're current?
Well, if you're current, you're speaking about the principal reduction?
Yeah.
Yeah, on the principal reduction, yes, if you're current. Because, again, they know that it doesn't make sense for someone to pay, let's say, $80,000 for a house in an area where homes are going for $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they foreclose on it, they're going to get less money than, in a lot of cases, than the $50,000. So
but
it makes
told
sense to say,
that...
okay,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, it just makes sense.
But I understood that if you are current on your mortgage, which makes no sense to me, they don't talk to you about making any type of arrangements. You have to be behind in order for your mortgage company to talk about any types of agreements, which sounds crazy. If you get 3 months behind, all of a sudden you can get the attention of your mortgage company, whereas if you've been current the entire time you've been with them, they don't want to negotiate with you. That's what I understood the case to be.
Okay, well, that was previously that's the way it was.
Okay.
Before they got out of hand. Say, let's go back 2 years ago. If you were not delinquent, your servicer would say, would tell you, you know, we can't do anything because you're not delinquent. So the government stepped in and said, well, no, you know, if there is a, they call it a, if there's a potential for foreclosure, I mean, for delinquency, they call it intimate default, which basically means that because of your financial situation, you may default or start missing your payments. So now they can work with you. If you say, well, my income decreased, you know, or, you know, I got a divorce, my income decreased, or I got laid off, I got a new job with less pay, and you're still current, they still can modify the loan and work with you, even if you're current now. But 2 years ago, there was no one was basically doing it.
I didn't even know that changed. How do lenders look at a foreclosure when you're, let's just say, you lost your house and you're trying to get yourself prepared to maybe get ready to buy another house in, let's say, 6 months, and the foreclosure is showing on your credit report? How does a lender look at a past foreclosure?
Okay, well, depends on the lender. Let's start off with FHA. FHA required that the foreclosure be at least 2 years old. So if you're saying 6 months, that won't work.
Okay.
Conventional lenders require 3 years. So now, that's basically saying the lenders will not do a loan if you have not been out of foreclosure rather for 2 years or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you won't be in a position to purchase anything unless you buy on a contract from an owner carry.
Okay.
Now here's what I suggest is
okay.
that, you know, if a person planned to buy a home and they know they want to get an FHA loan in 2 years,
mm-hmm.
then they start rebuilding their credit. And they look at the credit scores, and they start focusing on rebuilding the credit scores and give themselves that two-year period to position themselves to get a FHA loan.
Okay. You mentioned earlier about a short sale. Explain a short sale, and then tell us, is that treated like a foreclosure on your credit report?
Okay, Carrie. Well, first of all, the short sale is basically when someone say, well, I don't want the property, but I don't want a foreclosure. So the mortgage company will agree, in most cases, to do a short sale, which means that you put the house on the market, and the mortgage company will say, well, we're willing to accept less than what's owed on the property. So let's say you owe $100,000, and they agree to a $85,000 short sale. And the property sells for $85,000. The case is closed, you don't have a foreclosure, the mortgage company got most of their principal back, and it's almost like a win-win situation. Now, the difference is with the short sale, you don't have the foreclosure on your credit record, which hurts a lot more than a short sale. Now, a short sale will show on your credit report, but it does less damage than a foreclosure.
Really? So on the short sale, all you're really going to see is that there were some late payments and then the house got paid off. Whereas the foreclosure is going to say you lost the house to the mortgage company.
Yes, and that's a lot more damaging.
Okay.
Let me tell you one other thing on that. Also, the good thing about it is when you put the house up for sale on a short sale, that buys you time also because they will generally give you about 90 to 120 days to try to sell the house.
Hmm.
So you still buy time also.
Okay. Gotcha. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHD's 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, Can I Stop My Foreclosure? We're speaking with credit and foreclosure expert Mr. Ray Williams, and he's president of Greenway Capital Management. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening via the Internet, dial in at 347-850-8390, and again, press 1. Now, Ray, we know that you also deal a lot with credit. You have a lot of experience. I think you said 22 years of experience dealing with credit. So tell us, as far as people who are getting in trouble with their credit right through here, the credit card companies have changed a lot. So the rules are not applying like maybe when you signed up. So tell us a little bit about how they're rating you versus how they used to. And if I went today and let's just say I owed $1,500 on a credit card, if I took and I paid them $700 of that $1,500, that's not going to necessarily mean that I'm going to be able to keep my $1,500 balance or that I'm necessarily going to be in any better light with them. Is that correct?
That's correct, Carrie. And the reason is because of the economy. A lot of banks are trying to reserve their money. So in a case where you have a certain credit limit and you pay that limit down and the mortgage company decide to lower your limit, that's in order for them to, you know, save money and put that money in reserves or invest that money somewhere else rather than let you use that money in the future. And what this does, what this does to the consumer, it actually hurts the consumer's credit score because the credit scoring system is based on what they call usage capacity, which means basically how much of your credit limit do you use, and, you know, we grade you for it. So, for example, in the $1,500 case, if you owe $1,500 on that credit limit, you're at 100% capacity, which brings your credit score down. But now let's say if you pay $750 and now you're at $750, you're at 50% capacity, that can increase your credit score. But now let's say if the credit card company cut your limit to $750, now you're back at 100% capacity, which can knock your credit score down. Because, again, it's based on usage capacity, and anytime you get up to generally 40% and above, your credit scores go down based on their usage. So just by your credit card company lowering your limits can actually hurt your credit scores, even if you've been paying on time, you know, month after month for years.
I hope y'all heard that. So paying a lump sum on your credit card does not guarantee you any better standing with the credit card company, and in some cases it can actually bring attention to your account sooner, and then, as you said, they may drop your limit.
Oh, yes, and that's happened a lot over the last couple of years. A lot of people have seen their limits. People who have 10,000, 20,000 limits have saw their credit limits cut in half in some cases. And now what can really be damaging, Carrie, is let's say if you have a $10,000 line of credit and you owe $6,000 and they cut your limit to $5,000, you know, and you still owe $6,000, now you're at, you know, you're over 100% capacity. So that damages your credit score even though you've been paying on time.
And a lot of people need to know
that. So people
that.
want to basically understand the credit scoring system and how certain movements can affect their credit scores. Because, you know, even when you're paying on time, unfortunately, you can have lower credit scores if you're not careful.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phone lines. Area code 901-789. Good afternoon. You're on Center Stage.
Hey, Carrie. How you doing?
Hi. How you doing?
All right. It's Perry.
Hey, Perry Steele. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How you doing, sir?
All right. I heard something I want to ask you if it's true or not. Then I'm going to something else. But I've talked to a guy, and they're in trouble. Well, they're not in trouble with, but they're after Wells Fargo. But what they were saying Wells Fargo was doing, that Wells Fargo will foreclose you, take your house, but you still have to pay property taxes, even though you're not physically in your house anymore. So I want to know, is that true?
Well, sir, I really, depending on what state you're in, I really can't say because I'm not familiar with all the state property laws.
I'm in Tennessee.
But in most areas, if you don't own the property, then you have no legal obligation to pay taxes on that property. Because once that property is transferred, the taxes transfer with the ownership of the property. Now, again, certain states may have different laws than what we have here in Texas, where if you're a delinquent on those taxes, before it's sold, they may hold you up, you know, you may be obligated to still pay those taxes. But, again, I'm not familiar with Tennessee laws, but in Texas that would never go over. Because
I see what you're saying. You're saying, okay, let's say during the foreclosure period, I let me put it this way. During the foreclosure period, I couldn't pay my rent mortgage, so quite naturally, I couldn't pay my taxes. So once I get kicked out, I could still owe. I could still owe taxes.
Well, no, you shouldn't owe because, again, in most states.
I'm talking about if I wasn't paying my mortgage and I wasn't paying my taxes, then, like I said, then once I lose my house, I shouldn't owe no taxes.
I think he's talking about rates for the time he was in the house. Is that what you're saying?
Right. But from the time I was in the house, I couldn't pay my mortgage. Like, maybe I went 6 months without paying my mortgage, so that's 6 months where I couldn't pay my taxes. Because when I pay my mortgage company pays my taxes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the PIT was in the payment.
Right, 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 right. My property taxes is in my payment. So if I hadn't paid my mortgage in 6 months, then that's 6 months in behind the property tax. All I want to know, well, if I get kicked out, would I still have to pay that 6 months?
No, sir, that's what I'm saying. The taxes passes with the property.
Oh, okay, good.
So you're no longer, once that property is foreclosed, you're no longer responsible, even on those delinquent taxes.
Mm-hmm. So and then
those taxes passes with the property.
Okay, then one other question I'm going to ask you, and then I'm going to let it go. I wish this guy would quit, bro. God. Don't worry about it. What I was going to tell you? Oh, man, this guy throw me on. I wish that phone had run. That really messed me up because I wanted to ask you this question so bad about this mortgage. Here you go. Now, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, and these other banks and stuff, well, they'll tell me something. Is it true that foreign entities like China, Britain, and people who buy up American assets and stuff like that, do they actually own the deeds to these properties, some of these properties here in America, like people's homes?
Yes, sir, they do, because what happened is that when Wall Street was packaging mortgages and selling those mortgages as investments.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of foreign companies was investing in mortgages in the U.S., so they bought those portfolios of securities that Wall Street was selling. So, yes, a lot of cases the mortgages are actually owned by, entities in other countries.
So if you pay your house off, how are you going to get your mortgage?
No, you still have to pay. Now, your servicer services it, even though someone else actually owned the loan. And that's what the servicing comes. Like, for example, if you pay J.P. Morgan each month, you may not. They may not own the mortgage. They just service the mortgage.
So when everything is
down according to law, then you still get your clear title or deed to the property.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Perry Steele.
Next caller.
Another thing we find out, speaking of foreclosures again, 60,000 foreclosures were in Texas in 2010. That's a lot of foreclosures, folks. 60,000 in Texas alone. But going back to credit, when back in the day, just a couple of years ago, people were told if you don't want to be a victim of identity theft, you need to put a credit alert on your credit report. And so everybody was writing in, telling the three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, to put a credit alert on their credit reports. But now you're saying that's not the thing to do. The thing to do now is to put a lock on your credit report. Explain what a lock is.
Yes, Karen. Basically, you can, let's back up a step. There are a lot of companies who were promoting, self-proofing your credit by you sign up with this company, then they'll monitor your credit for you, et cetera. But basically, all the consumer has to do is contact the credit bureau and have them to put a lock on the credit, on their credit file, which basically means if there's any suspicious activity, that they'll contact you and inform you of that suspicious activity. So, for example, if someone applied for three credit cards in your name in 2 days, and that's not your pattern of doing business. Or if someone used a credit card, let's say if your credit card is stolen, and there's a pattern start to show that someone is spending money randomly on your credit card, then they'll notify you. But in that case, they'll notify your credit card company also. And sometimes your credit card company will be monitoring the card also So when they see the suspicious activity, they'll stop the card and won't let any transaction go through until they contact you. So you can basically just go online and sign up for an identification theft program with the credit bureaus, and it's free.
Okay. How often should someone pull their credit report?
On the average, once every 6 months. And it depends on what you're trying to do. You know, if you just want to monitor your credit, I always suggest once every 6 months. Or sometimes, in some cases, once per year. But at least the once per year, but I, you know, I always recommend once every 6 months. Now, if you're trying to accomplish a certain goal, such as increasing your credit scores,
mm-hmm.
you may want to pull it, you know, every 6 months. And you know, let's say, for example, you're trying to raise your credit score from 600 to 650, and you have a plan in place to increase your scores, and you implement your plan, and you make certain transactions, then you go in and check your credit score after, say, 6 months to see where your score is.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at least, like, say, every 6 months.
Now, for those people who are credit challenged, and that's half the world today, all these companies pop up. A lot of them don't even have storefronts. They're just, you know, out of somebody's kitchen or something. And they're saying, we, for $800, can fix your credit. You know, all you need to do is give us $800, and in 30 days, we can raise your credit score by, you know, this many points. Are those things legit, and should you trust them?
Well, my personal opinion is most of them are not legitimate, and you can't trust some of them. But what I recommend is that whoever you sign up with, ask them, what's the plan? How do you plan to raise to get my scores? What is the game plan? And that's the most important. Some people will tell you, well, we'll get negative items removed from your credit report. Now, what consumers have to understand is that a negative item can mean an item that is on your report legally, and they're saying, well, we'll remove it. But see, the consumer, if it's illegally, you can get it removed as a consumer. And let's say, for example, if it's an account that's over 7 years old, and this person, company go in and look at the date and see that that company hasn't reported on that file, on that account, rather, in the last 3 years, then a lot of cases that means that company is no longer tracking that particular account. So if you dispute it, there's a good chance that it'll come off anyway.
But see, what I keep hearing people say is they went through these credit repair places. I gave somebody $500. I gave someone $750. They made me all these promises, and it came off for a period of time, and then it popped back up. So when you say that it'll probably come off, is it a possibility that it'll probably come back?
Oh, yes. And the reason is because what happens is that anytime you dispute something, the credit bureau, let me back up. Okay, let's say the credit bureau contacts the creditor regarding the account, and the creditor do not verify that the information is correct. Then within 30 days, then the credit bureau will take that account off the file. But now, if that company comes back in 60 days and verify that account, then it goes back on. So that's why I say if people don't have a game plan, you know, other than we're going to get this removed from your report, that's not a good system. Because, again, like you say, if they remove it, it may show up again in 60 days or 90 days or 120 days. So you basically have not accomplished anything. And the company, unfortunately, they did their job because they did get it removed.
And they're not going to give you your money back. You just tuned in. You're listening to the all-new KLAC 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, Can I Stop My Foreclosure? We're speaking with Mr. Ray Williams. He is a foreclosure and credit expert with Greenway Capital Management here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening via the Internet, dial in at 347-850-8390. And, again, press 1. Also, you know, I'm the type of person, I don't trust my social with anybody. So if I'm one of these people who wanted to, let's just say, clean my own credit up, How would I go about it? What are just some simple steps that you can give us that people can go about cleaning up their own credit?
Well, I always recommend, if possible, pay anything that you can. You know, negotiate for a lower payoff.
Mm.
Again, that's the most important thing, is that you have an account that shows it's paid, even if it's a paid charge-off. Because, again, based on the credit scoring system, that paid charge-off account can get points on your score, opposed to actually having it removed. So let's say, again, if that person owes $500 on a credit card, and that account is 5 years old, then they may negotiate to pay that company $125 and sell that account for less money. Now, that account will show as a paid collection account, but again, they get more points the fact that they paid it. Now, another strategy is to basically look at everything on the report and then decide, well, what's the best way to approach each one of these accounts? Yeah, again, if there's an account, let's say an automobile that was repossessed, and there's a deficiency judgment filed after the repossession. And let's say the deficiency amount is $8,000. Well, no way you're going to pay $8,000 for a car that you don't have. So you may want to go in and negotiate to pay $2,000 or maybe $1,000 on the deficiency.
For the car
or
that you don't have?
You can just leave it there.
For the car that you don't have?
Yes. Well, again, our objective is to put yourself in a position to lessen the impact of that deficiency judgment. Because, again, now I'm not saying that you should pay the $1,000, that's up to you. But let's say if you don't want to pay the $1,000, you don't want to pay anything, then the only other alternative is to just let that account stay there and age. And the older the account gets, the less weight it'll have against your credit score.
Okay.
But now, another strategy would be is to let the account stay in place and age, and at the same time, you reestablish your credit and start rebuilding credit, and your new credit will offset that of the old credit as it gets older. So, again, that's why I say you need to have a strategy when you're trying to rebuild your credit scores.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these companies that talk about or advertise getting items removed, most of them don't have a strategy. And at Greenway Management, that's what we do. We put a strategy in place to help you get your credit scores back up.
Okay. For those people who are trying to, as I said, maybe due to their budget, can't afford to pay someone to clean up their credit, and they're attempting to do it by themselves, one thing I know that people should be careful of, and I think you'll co-sign this, is when you call the creditor and you say, I owe you $5,000, but I really only have $2,500. And the creditor says, okay, fine, send me the $2,500. Should you ask for a letter immediately for that $2,500, because things tend to happen once they get to $2,500 sometimes?
Oh, yes. You never want to send any money until you have an agreement in writing, a signed agreement. The way it basically should work is that if they give you a verbal agreement, then they should send you a letter with the same verbiage saying, we will accept this payment in full. And once you get that, then it's done. But if you do it verbally and you send $2,500, then you have no recourse for them to stand by the $2,500 as full payment.
And I have seen
situations.
Haven't you seen situations in which people sent the money and then the creditor says, well, no, that's not the agreement. You still owe us $2,500 more?
Well, yes, if it's not in writing, they can always do that because there's no evidence that there was ever agreement for a lesser amount. So that's why I always suggest that you get it in writing and don't pay until you get it in writing.
Okay. And I think the thing is, though, you have to be very careful when you're negotiating with the credit card companies or whoever it is that you owe, because you got to realize, what do they always tell you when they call you? We are trying to collect on a debt. These people are professional collectors.
Oh, yes. Yes, and they know what works, what don't work in most cases. And, you know, by law, they do have to inform you that they are collecting a debt. And but now one thing you don't want to do is verify information. If you're, especially if you're not, even if you are sure of it, you know, you don't want to verify the information because basically you have said that if they say, well, you owe us $5,000, and you say yes, then you agree that you owe them $5,000.
Exactly.
So,
your language
kind of
changed. You mean
you're
it was, you know, I owe $2,500. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, yeah, well, see, yeah, you could say, well, I don't know. You know, you can basically say, I'm not sure of what the amount was because that was so long ago.
Okay.
But you don't want to give them a affirmative on your account.
And we have found out lately that the credit collectors are getting more aggressive. What did you tell me about how aggressive they're getting lately?
Okay, well, it's because of the lawsuits. They're starting to file a lot more lawsuits because what they found out is that these lawsuits work. And now what happened, particularly in Texas, 2 years ago, they raised the limit on credit card debt that collection account, collection agencies could file against. For example, a company could not file a lawsuit if the debt was more than $5,000. So if you owe someone $5,000, they could file a lawsuit. But if you owe them say $5,500 or more,
really?
Or $5,001 or more, they could not file a lawsuit. Yeah. But a few years ago, Texas changed the law to $10,000. So all of a sudden, these companies that had these larger credit card collections started filing lawsuits. And the thing is, the lawsuits work because, again, most consumers don't know a lawsuit, you know, it's just that. It's just a lawsuit. It doesn't mean you owe them. It doesn't mean you have to pay. It means that they're challenging you in court. Now, the mistake most consumers make, which is, I think it's something like 89%, is that they don't show up for court.
Ooh.
And when you don't show up for court, then the collection agency win your case by default.
Wow.
So you basically gave them the case if you don't show up. Now, the good side of it is if you do show up for court, and even if they win, they can do, in most cases, they still can't do anything, because particularly if you don't have the money. Now, some states, again, because of the various laws, they may garnish your check or bank account. In Texas, they won't garnish your accounts.
No, in Texas, they will garnish your bank account, correct?
Yeah, but they cannot garnish your paycheck.
Gotcha. But people in Texas, trust me, they can go into your bank account and levy it for whatever it is that you owe them, correct?
Oh, yeah, they can go into the account, so... Let's say, for example, if you don't want them to get the money, you basically, and you get your paycheck, then you don't put your paycheck in the bank.
Mm.
But see, some states, they can garnish your paycheck, but Texas, they cannot garnish your paycheck.
But they can still
like
take every penny you got in your bank account. It's up to the amount that you owe them.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, they can do that.
Okay. But
basically... you want to work with them, and that's another reason that you want to work with collection agencies whenever possible, so they won't have to surprise you and garnish your check. But now also they have to get a court order before they can garnish the check.
Okay.
And
so,
you have to know about the court order also.
So they have to serve you?
Yes, because you have to go to court anyway. And it's the judge, you know, going, you know, now the judge orders that you pay, then they have a right to garnish your check, I mean, your bank account. But to avoid that, what I'm saying, Carrie, is just work with the creditors before you get to a point where you have to go to court and try to get them to garnish it, let them garnish your bank account.
But, you know, from what I heard... Listen how I say that. From what I heard, the bill collectors, when they call, they're so demeaning to you. They're so nasty, you know, and they make threats. I mean, they'll say things like they can take your home. That's not even true, is it?
No, not in. Well, I'm speaking again in Texas, yeah, for sure. they cannot take you home because in Texas, no one can put a lien on your home or take your home if the home was not used as collateral in the transaction.
Hmm.
And even though some we are threatened to do these things, because as I told you, someone sent me some evidence that this particular collector sent a citation out delivered by a sheriff, and in the citation they said that they would put a lien against the house for $5,900 credit card debt, and you cannot do that in Texas. So they do use some tactics that's unscrupulous. As of Thursday, so far in January, there were 453 lawsuits against collection agencies in federal court.
Really? So consumers
suing credit collection agencies for unfair tactics.
Really? Okay. And there's a ton of them out there. They have a certain time period in which they're supposed to call you during the day. I think they're not supposed to call you after, what, 8, 8.30 at night?
9.
9.
Well, anywhere between 8 in the morning and 9 p.m.
9 p.m.
Your time, whatever state you're in.
Really? And so they're not supposed to harass you, though. Isn't there a certain lingo that they cannot say to you, though, as being a collector? They can't just say anything they want, can they?
Oh, no. Under the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act, they are, they're not supposed to use profanity. They're not supposed to threat or even make accusations of a threat. They're not supposed to, threaten to do bodily harm or have anyone else to do bodily harm. They're not supposed to threaten to have you arrested. So there are certain guidelines under Fair Credit Debt Collection practice.
Okay.
But again, they do it because, unfortunately, most consumers don't report it.
Mm.
So that's why so many collection agencies get away, because consumers don't report the abuse.
Okay, who do they report it to?
They can report it to the Federal Trade Commission. They can report it to their local state attorney general's office.
Really? So there is a recourse.
Oh, yes.
One thing you said earlier, when you're talking about the fact that they can sue you if it's $5,000 and under, and then they raise it to if it was $10,000, it looks like to me then if they were smart and they were savvy, they could just drop it below that amount and just sue you for that amount. Can they not do that, or do they have to stick with what you owe them as part of their suit?
No, as long as the amount doesn't exceed whatever the law is. So like you said, if they want to drop it and say, well, you owe us $4,500 and that's $5,000,
then they can
file a lawsuit.
Okay, so they can still. Okay, that's what I thought. I would think that they would probably be savvy enough to do that trick rather than just lose all the money that they would be leaving on the table with dealing with just a couple of thousand dollars here or there.
Oh, yes, because any tactic that works for them. Like, so that's what their objective is to collect. Again, what consumers have to realize is that on a lot of these accounts, collection agencies, third-party collection agencies, generally pay less than 50 cents on the dollar, and in some cases only 10 cents on the dollar for those accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you did owe $5,000, if they pay 10 cents on the dollar for that account, and they only pay, say, $500 for that account. So if they can collect $1,500 on that account, they're doing very well.
Hey. What kind of tips could you give people when they're talking to a creditor? What should you say versus what should you not say when they get you on the telephone? What should you say and what should you not say?
Okay, let's assume that they are being polite, first of all. First of all, you want to find out information about who you owe, how much you owe, who owns the account. Let's say, because sometimes the collection agency may not own the account, they may just be collecting for whoever, the credit card company or the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So you just want to get information on the account yourself. Now, one thing you should not do is, again, confirm how much is owed on the account, because you don't know, especially if it was an old account, you may think you owe $3,000, but you may have actually owed, you know, $2,700. So if they say, well, we have an account and you owe us $3,000, you could say, well, I'm not sure of that. You know, do you have proof of that? Because by law, the creditor, the collection agency is obligated to prove that you owe that account.
Well, what would you
but
want to
if you,
go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, but if you know, but if you you know, if you affirm that you owe that amount, then they don't have to prove it because you already said, yes, I owe it. Okay, go ahead.
Why would you want to talk to them though? I guess I don't get it. Why most people like say that when 800 numbers come in, they don't even answer the 800 numbers because they know they're bill collectors. Why would you want to talk to them? I mean, I guess I don't understand, because you're saying basically don't affirm anything they're saying. So what is the purpose of really talking to them on the phone? Because I think their pattern is to call every day, two or three times a day, is it not? So what would be the purpose of talking to them? If you don't have the money today, you know you're not going to have the money tomorrow, what's the purpose of holding the conversation?
Well, you want to let them, one, you want to let them know that you're not trying to avoid them. Because, you know, again, if you try to avoid them, they're going to keep calling anyway.
But aren't you trying to avoid them, really? I mean, isn't that what you're doing? In most cases, people are trying to avoid them because they don't have the money.
Yeah, but see, when you, Gary, when you talk to them, you and you tell them that, and you let them know, well, you know, just tell them, just be straight with them. Let them know, well, you know, you can continue to call, but I don't have the money. And that's, you know, and now it doesn't make sense for them to spend manpower time calling someone who has told them they don't have the money, you know. Now, another good thing about it, if you speak with them on a particular day, they can no longer call you. They cannot call you again that same day.
Okay.
And
okay,
if you don't speak, they don't speak with you, they call you 10 times, 20 times per day along until they get to speak to someone, at least particularly the consumer they're trying to reach. So you don't want them calling all day, just, you know, speak to them, tell them you don't have the money, and they cannot call back that particular day. So, no, you always want to speak with them, but now that's only if they're being sensible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you get an abusive person, you speak with them also, you know, because, number one, they can't call you that particular day. Number two, if you're straightforward and just let them know that they can call again the next day and the day after, but you still don't have the money, then that's up to them. If they want to call knowing that you don't have the money, they want to waste the manpower.
Can they call
but
your job?
But it is good to speak with them.
Can they call your job?
Yes, they do have they can call your job as long as you have not notified them not to call your job.
Oh.
And the best way to do that is to send them a certified letter and tell them that your employer did not accept calls, private calls.
And that will stop
and
it?
Allow, yeah, they have that. That's federal law. Matter of fact, if you send the same letter, basically the proper wording is a cease and desist letter to the credit card, the collection agency, and telling them not to call your home, they can no longer call your home.
Really? Okay,
and
so
that's federal law.
Okay, so to stop calls altogether, all you do is send a what kind of letter?
Cease and desist.
Okay. And that's saying don't call
me
anymore.
Correct. And you send a certified mail to make sure that they received it.
Listen, y'all, did y'all hear that, America? All you have to do is send them that letter, and they can't call your house, and they can't call your job. I wonder how many heart attacks and strokes that would have saved some people if they just knew that they could send a letter to the creditors and tell them, stop harassing them.
It would save people a lot of stress, but, again, consumers don't know. And, again, Carol, that brings up a point of Greenway Capital Management. That's one of the classes we teach is the credit management class.
Tell us about that.
And that's a four-hour class.
Tell us about that.
Okay, well, that class, same thing. We educate consumers how to deal with credit issues. And that's from, you know, handling bill collectors to managing their credit, increasing credit scores, et cetera. Because, again, we believe that, you know, an educated consumer is the best consumer. So, you know, rather than pay someone $800, $1,200 to, say, remove items from your credit, You know, it makes more sense to pay someone to teach you how the system works, and you use that the rest of your life. So again,
there's one thing that you taught me that you talk about in that class is disparity in credit reporting or credit scoring. Tell us what that's about.
Well, yes, in the credit scoring, there's a lot of disparity. Now, a lot of the disparities are not anything racially motivated. It's just that, unfortunately, minorities have lower credit scores than non-minorities. And a lot of times that has to do with education and understanding. Mm-hmm. Like you said, sometimes people don't want to talk to their creditors, even when they're not delinquent, and they may become delinquent. Instead of saying, well, let me call them and let them know I cannot make my payment, they just won't make the payment. And fear, sometimes it's fear. Let me give you an example on a car payment. You know, sometimes people miss their car payments because of financial situation, and they don't know they can do the same thing. They can call the whoever they have the account and say, hey, I'm having financial problems. I need a 30-day extension. And a lot of times they will give a 30, some will give up to a 60-day extension, but you have to call them next month if you need an additional extension. So, you know, just by taking action, you can basically eliminate a lot of the stress. But again, sometimes people don't know what action to take.
I agree. Explain the beginning, because a lot of people, you know, repos are something that happens a lot. Do people understand the difference between a voluntary repo and an involuntary repo? Because there is a difference. And if so, how do they how do they rate in terms of your credit report? Are they rated the same?
They are the same, basically. There's no difference. let's say, for example, voluntary repossession, meaning, you know, you say, well, I cannot afford this car, and you can have it back. And, you know, they come pick it up, or you take it back to the dealership, and that's it. Involuntary, meaning they contact you, and you won't, you know, trying to get payment, and you won't make payment, and then you wake up one morning, and your car is gone. But as far as the effect on credit, there is no difference for the way it affects your credit.
So I think the only difference may be that your neighbors don't see them come take your car. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's the only difference is you don't get a surprise, you know, when you walk out from your job or wake up one morning.
Yeah, and it's gone, and everybody saw them come take it. Right, okay. A lot of people think that a lot of, and then I think even the creditor may tell you that if you give it back to me as opposed to this, that, or the other, it won't go as bad on your credit. So they'll lie to them sometimes.
Well, because, again, they want to give people the impression that they're helping them, you know, and then plus it saves them money because they don't have to pay for a repo filing. They don't, you know, they don't have to pay, you know, a repo person to try to track you down, et cetera. It's easy for them to convince you to just turn the car over.
So you gave us a tip about buying investment property as opposed to buying a home to live in. Share that tip with the audience.
Oh, yes, yeah, that's one of my favorite because so many times I hear people say, well, a home is your biggest investment. You know, whereas in reality, most homes are not an investment. Most people don't buy a home as an investment. They buy it as a place to live in.
Mm-hmm.
But now my take on it is if you are buying a home and you want a home to be an investment, then you should buy a rental property to live in. Now, for example, I always use buying a duplex, triplex, or fourplex because anything up to a fourplex is considered and financed as a single-family home. So let's say, for example, you're a single person or you're a married person with one child and you don't need a house or a big house or any house. You just want a place to live. Then why not buy a fourplex and you live in, and your family live in one side, and you rent the other three units out. Now you have the best of both worlds because now you have three tenants that's paying rent. In essence, they're paying the mortgage on this whole property. You're paying nothing. Now, since you bought it as a single-family home, you still get your tax deductions. And then on the other three sides, you get to write off the expenses of maintaining those three sides just like a regular rental property.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of advantages to, you know, starting, if you want to become an investor, is making your home, your resident, your investment property by purchasing a duplex up to a fourplex.
Okay. Explain ratios for those people who, if they're not careful, will find themselves in foreclosure situations in the future because they don't understand the process of buying a home that is within your means. Because a lot of times people get confused what they are allowed to buy in terms of the borrower say, I mean the broker or the mortgage company saying you can have a house, you know, that's up to XYZ. They may tell you that you qualify up to $170,000. Well, people don't understand sometimes what ratios mean in terms of buying a house. So to avoid someone possibly going into a foreclosure in the future because when they buy their next house, they don't understand buying the house that you really can afford as opposed to what the lender is telling you that you can afford, what would you explain to them in terms of ratio so that they could understand how much house to buy?
Okay, Carol, based on the ratios, basically the ratios say, well, based on your income, you can afford X amount of payment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that ratio, you know, they have what they call the front and back ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And the back ratio basically meaning, you know, with all the other debts you have. So let's say, for example, if the mortgage company say the debt rate, your ratio can be high as 42%. So basically that means, with everything else you're paying, including the mortgage, 42% of your income can go towards, you know, all your debt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's fine in most cases. But what happens after you buy the house and you accumulate more debt, so now you may have qualified at 38, but now you may have went out and bought another car or charged some credit cards. Now you may be at 80% debt ratio. So you always want to maintain a certain debt ratio, meaning how much of your income goes towards paying debt each month.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it's good to be under 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're at 60%, that means you have 40% cash left over after you pay everything each month.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, most Americans are generally in the 70 to maybe average, 70 to 80% debt ratio, and some over 100% debt ratio. So, again, you know, when you're buying a home, you want to be realistic after you buy the home, and you also want to focus on keeping your ratio, your debt ratio down. And let me give you a quick example, Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
I used to see this a lot when people would buy a new home. Now, they bought the new home. Now they need new furniture. So they go out and charge up new furniture. Now, some people, they want a new car to go with the new home. So then maybe a year later, they go out and buy a new car. So they start accumulating more debt on top of the home that they qualified at the time to buy the home and to pay, and they could afford the payments. But now they've overextended themselves because they wanted to furnish the house a certain way. They wanted the car to go with the house.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's a matter of being in control of your managing your debt.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. Because what we found, there were over 2 million houses foreclosed upon in the last 2 years. It said 2 million homeowners, actually 2,080,380 to be exact, homeowners have already lost their homes to foreclosure over the last 2 years. So it's kind of like catching a certain diseases. It's avoidable, folks, if you just pay attention to certain rules, because a lot of times most of the people that got in foreclosure trouble was because they got on adjustable rate mortgages, like we said, interest-only loans, bought more house than they really should have, and those were some of the things that led up to people getting in trouble. So really, if you're going to buy today, you really need to be smart about what you're getting and buy a house that you're going to be able to keep as opposed to getting one to compete with a family member or a neighbor or whatever the situation may be. So what type of credit scores are needed today, Ray, for someone to get like an A-paper loan? A-paper people are for those people who have good credit, I mean the really good scores. What type of credit scores are needed today to get the FHA loans or to get the conventional, what they call A-paper loans? What kind of credit scores are you looking at?
Okay, well, let's start with FHA. FHA will accept credit scores as low as 500. But now A paper, generally they're looking at a 650 to 700 score. Now conventional, most conventional lenders are looking at are about a 720 and above for A paper.
Okay.
So basically meaning that's, if you have those scores, you can get the best rate. But also if you have lower scores, you can still get financing, but you won't get the best rate. But generally, most people, if you want to get an A paper loan, or rate rather, you want to be at least 700 to 720 because it varies by each lender also on what they consider as an A paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For those people who don't know where the credit scores are today, which everybody should know what your credit score is, what websites can they go to safely and securely pull their credit report without fear of someone stealing their Social Security number and, being a victim of identity theft or something?
Okay, Kay, well, the official site is annualcreditreport.com. Now, with annualcreditreport.com, you can go on and pull your report from all three credit bureaus without the scores. There's no charge. But if you want your scores, then you have to pay for your scores. And I think it's still $15 for each credit bureau, so about $45. Now, there's another site called Credit Karma. That's Credit, KARMA.com. You can go there and pull a report and get two free credit scores. So you have two choices there where you can go. You don't need a credit card. You don't need to buy any type of additional services. But
okay.
The official site is annualcreditreport.com.
Okay. Say someone pulls a credit report and they're shocked themselves at what they see. If you have a situation in which you maybe walked away from an apartment without finishing a lease and maybe, you had a repo on a car several years ago and maybe you had some credit card debt that you did not pay out, what should they do if they're interested in buying a home? How do they get themselves ready to get their credit cleaned up so that they can buy that home? What should they do in those situations?
Well, first they want to, again, pull the report and see exactly what's on there, how it's reported, who's reporting it. Then you want to address those issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing, because it may take a while. Sometimes it may take 6 months, 8 months, or in some cases a year. It depends on how you address the issue. For example, let's say you have a repossessed car that has an $8,000 deficiency judgment, and you don't want to pay that $8,000. So now you're going to have to find some other way to build your credit scores up and let that deficiency judgment stay on there. So one of the plans might would be to get a couple, one or two or three, whatever you can afford, secured credit cards and start using those cards in order to increase your scores.
Okay.
That's one of the most common methods.
That's the best one. Okay. Is there a way that people can track? Because now is a good time to buy a home, whether investment or a home to live in. So in order so that you understand what the market is doing in the particular area that you may be looking in, is there a way that a person can track how many foreclosures are in a particular area so that they'll know what the market is doing in that particular area?
Well, they can. But now, a lot of those areas is based on foreclosure filings.
Mm-hmm.
So they can go to there's a company called Realty Track, R-E-A-L-T-Y, Track, T-R-A-C.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they can pull up the statistics. And they can pull up those statistics by zip code.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, you pull up that information, you can just click or input the zip code that you have an interest in, and it'll pull up how many properties foreclosed in that area. Now, if you want to pay for information, you can pay for information from that company, and you can get the historical foreclosures for that area. So if you wanted to go back 2 years, say, or a year, then you can buy that information.
Okay.
But, again, foreclosures, it varies. So, but there are some areas, particularly zip codes, that have higher foreclosure rates than others.
Okay. And let's be clear to the audience, too, that Foreclosures hurts both the investor and it hurts the homeowner. So it's in everybody's best interest, if possible, to try to stay in the house. So if you have been trying to, let's just say, work it out with the mortgage company and things have not been working out so good, is there a situation in which you can file a bankruptcy to actually stop a foreclosure?
Well, yes, you can, but that's one I recommend against. Now, if it's a case where it's a last ditch effort, for example, if your foreclosure is coming up this Tuesday and that's the only thing you can do, then yes, you may want to use that. Now, a possible drawback with that is that once you file foreclosure, in most cases, the lenders will not accept payments. So what you find there is while you're in foreclosure, the payments start to accumulate. Now, if you're saving that money, that's fine. But what happens is that, particularly if you file a Chapter 13, they can put the delinquent payments in the Chapter 13, but they cannot put the current payments in the Chapter 13. So you are paying on the delinquent payments, but you're still obligated to make your regular payments on time.
Okay.
So it does stop the foreclosure, but now if the mortgage company temporarily stopped accepting payments, you're getting further behind. So if you miss 8 or 10 payments because you're in bankruptcy at $800 per month, so if you are not prepared to drop $8,000 or so in a few months, then you get further behind as long as you're in the bankruptcy. So if you stay in bankruptcy for, say, 2 years or 3 years, all those payments are accumulating. So it can hurt you, actually. It can hurt you if you're not careful.
But if you're in a situation where your back is against the wall and you are absolutely about to lose the house, a bankruptcy is the only option, right?
Well, that's assuming that you have exhausted every other option.
Okay. So just to be clear,
one problem is sometimes people use bankruptcy as the first option, and that's not the way you should do it.
Okay. And one other thing we found out that the situation with all of these mortgage companies doing some of the things that they've done that were against the rules completely, the attorney generals in all 50 states are looking into this. So I would suggest if I were somebody who had lost my house, was questioning whether or not they did me wrong, I think I would be calling my attorney general. And I think I would be yelling as loud as I could, possibly from the rooftop, to say, hey, I think they took my house and I have a situation here that I want to talk to you about. I think I sent my paperwork in 11 times, or I understood that everything was okay because I talked to Jane Stokes, and, you know, I document it every time we talk. And, you know, so I think people should not take it lying down if they feel like they were wrong, because they said in a lot of these cases, these people's houses were taken wrongfully. And so everyone who thinks possibly, I think you need to flood their phone lines at your attorney general's office just to see if they got you wrong, because I don't think they have anything to lose. Do you, Ray?
Oh, no, they really don't have more to gain. And let me point out one other statistic. I think it was like 87% of people who sought counseling were able to get modification and foreclosure avoidance. So basically, again, you know, taking action is where you win. And so you can't just do nothing.
And I think, too, though, when it's been proven, and they talk to Congress and they talk to the Senate, and it's being proven that these guys did some unethical stuff, now is the time to uprise, like they're doing in Egypt. It's time to uprise against the mortgage companies and the servicers now in order for this to stop and not happen again, because I think unless they're pressed to make some changes, this is not going to get any better.
Well, it's not the care, because they've already projected by, I think it's 2012 or 13, there will be a total of approximately 10 million homes foreclosed on.
That's a lot of houses. Okay, Ray, give me 60 seconds and tell us about Greenway Capital Management and how you can help someone who has credit or foreclosure problems.
Okay, well, Terry, Greenway Capital Management, basically we're in the business of helping consumers manage their personal finance. And we basically do what we call holistic financial management, which basically means we look at everything that a consumer has, from credit card, credit debt, to mortgage debt, let's say anything dealing with personal finance. And we take those, their clients, and we basically set goals and objectives to make sure they get to where they're trying to go, for increasing credit scores, eliminating debt, whatever it is. We also are in the business of education, and that's why we provide the foreclosure prevention classes and the credit management classes, because, again, we want consumers to be educated. We don't want consumers to keep making the same mistakes over and over. And the best way to offset that is through education.
Okay.
And we mentor consumers because, again, we can't give them everything in a one-day, few-hour class. But those classes are only designed to provide basic information. And then if they take advantage of the mentoring side, then they basically continue their education over a year's period. So it's basically taking action because, again, unfortunately, so many things happen because consumers don't understand what's happening. They don't think they have any recourse. They think they need money to get an attorney, and so they do nothing. But I always encourage people to take some type of action. Don't just sit back and and assume that the mortgage company is trying to help you. In a lot of cases, they're not.
Okay. Mr. C.D. McGee in the chat room wants to know, do you think there's going to be another housing crash?
Well, yes, eventually there will, but that won't happen for, I foresee, at least for years to come, because this is a great experience for the American housing market. And again, it was because of the Wall Street packaging the loans and settling these loans off with all the and financing properties with all this creative financing. So we learned a lesson from that. So there will always be some type of housing crash, but it won't be because of the bad loans. It may be because of the economy and jobs. So this is current. So we won't see another one, I don't think, for maybe another 20 or 30 years. 30 years.
And they changed a lot of loans.
Will be based on economic reasons.
Because they changed a lot of the loan programs now, so you can't, really make some of the mistakes that you made last time or before.
Correct, yes. You can't go out and get a no documentation loan where you don't have to prove that you have income, and you can have a 500 credit score.
Yeah, you can't do that anymore.
We won't see that again.
Well, this is true. We'd like to say thank you to Ray Williams, president of Greenway Capital Management, for being with us today. If you have a credit or a foreclosure situation, I think you should reach out to Ray at 888-318-4069, extension 700. Again, if you have a credit or a foreclosure situation, reach out to Ray Williams, the president of Greenway Capital Management, at 888-318-4069, extension 700, or reach him via his website at www.gcm.yolasite.com. So www.gcm.yolasite.com. Also, a reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or our host. Last week's show is a must hear. That was when the Scott Sisters and Dick Gregory were our guests. We've gotten national attention because of that show, so if you haven't heard it, I suggest you check it out. I'd like to say to everyone, thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hello?